Welcome to our continuing audiocast series from IFR, the magazine for the accomplished pilot. Learn more or subscribe at ifr-magazine.com.
We're talking with Greg Lewis, Deputy Director of the National Test Pilot School in Mojave, California. Greg has over 7,300 hours in more than 100 different aircraft, most of it in flight testing, and aircraft as wide-ranging as the F-16 to the PAC-750XL single-engine turboprop. Greg, to keep current on a variety of different aircraft, how do you get ready to climb into an airplane you haven't flown for a while?
I'm confronted with that problem, actually, quite a lot. I'm lucky enough in my job here at the Test Pilot School to get to fly 13 different aircraft types fairly routinely.
Wow.
Because of the way we operate, though, I might not get to fly some of them for extended periods, like our turboprop C-47L that gets used in specific portions of the course. The answer to your question, the short answer, is that I get ready, rely heavily on checklists. The flying skills that I use for all those different types of airplanes really don't change that much. If you pull back on the stick, at least for a while, the trees get smaller in all the different airplanes I fly. Procedures and the systems, the limitations, what speed you should fly, all these can differ quite a bit. And relying on memory is not a good idea with that many different types. So I'm pretty religious about using the checklist and going step by step.
Speaking of all those different airplanes, I'm sure you've had to fly a lot of airplanes that you and maybe nobody else knew very much about. While few pilots have that experience, checking out in an aircraft that's new to the pilot is really a commonplace sort of thing. So what tips do you have that could be applied to just Joe Average pilot learning to fly a new aircraft?
Probably doesn't even need to be said, but thorough study of the flight manual is huge. When I'm doing that for an airplane that I haven't ever flown or one that I just haven't flown for a while, I like to make what I call one-page cheat sheets. And that is I just make notes on a typically an 8.5, 5x8 kind of card of key facts. Those things might be limitations, specific normal and emergency configurations and speeds that I might need to do. Which EPs I should commit to memory. Just the act of making the cheat sheet helps me retain the material, and then I can use it as a quick reference just before going out to fly or sometimes even in flight if required.
Well, I'd imagine that just by the nature of the job, you might, regardless of how much preparation you have, be caught off guard by an aircraft. Has that ever happened to you?
Looking back, it hasn't happened very often. But there are three cases that come to mind. And as I look back on them, all of them happened while I was pushing an airplane out towards its limits on the edge of the flight envelope, if you will. On a maintenance flight once on an F-4, I had an engine compressor stall approaching Mach 2. It really got my heart pumping because as you're approaching that Mach 2 limit, which is really the limit of the airplane, you can just feel the airplane straining and then when you get this sudden loud bang and a big yaw acceleration, it really gets your attention. But it really turned out to be a non-event in the end. Another, perhaps closer to being a disaster, was a planned inverted deep stall in a swept wing Delta aircraft.
You said a planned inverted deep stall?
Yeah, we do training here, and some of the training we do is intentional departure spins, and in one of the types we fly, deep stalls, both erect and inverted. But one of those inverted deep stalls, which are usually very tame and easy to recover from, turned into a fast, flat, inverted spin,
wow.
Which, again, was pretty exciting. Not the kind of excitement you enjoy, typically, but pretty exciting. But the deployment of the spin chute did its job very well, and the recovery was actually okay.
Mm-hmm.
The last one that I could think back on was a flight test of new hardware, in-flight reversing engine. And at high dynamic pressure, the last test point in the matrix, it failed, which reverted to a fail-safe mode and turned out not to be a terrible thing. But the reverser didn't make it into any further in the development program. All those have in common the fact that I get caught by surprise at the edge of the envelope. If you want to avoid surprises, maybe it's good to avoid the edge of the envelope.
Well, let's talk about emergencies and how to handle them. What does the school teach about dealing with emergencies in flight?
Actually, Not much. It might sound surprising the way I said that, but we focus on avoiding emergencies rather than coming up with some special way to deal with an emergency. So we put a lot of effort into what we call risk mitigation. Whenever we do flight tests, we're naturally doing things for the first time or differently than typical, and because of that, we expose ourselves to some unique hazards that you wouldn't otherwise have. So we look at those hazards, we think about them hard, what could cause them, what could go wrong, and then we come up with minimizing procedures. So for each unique event that we're doing, we look to see what could happen, and we find a way to avoid something bad from occurring. Mm-hmm. For example, if we're going to do an event where we might lose control of the airplane, like that deep stall, then we specify a minimum altitude in order to go do that. That way we'll have time, altitude, in order to recover if the worst occurs.
Do you specify a minimum altitude for evacuating the aircraft if you have to?
Absolutely. If we're out of control, a number like 10,000 feet is typically used. If we're in control of the airplane, but we can't get back for some reason, like an engine failure away from a field, then we might use 2,000 feet.
Do you treat those as hard and fast rules? If you have a get out at 10,000 clause built into the flight test, do you are you expected to absolutely get out at 10,000 if the problem still exists there?
That is absolutely correct. That is the plan. Now, it's happened in other organizations that people violated that and actually survived and recovered the airplane, but that's not the plan. The plan is when you hit the predetermined number under a certain set of circumstances, then that's when you step over the side. But there's other things, too. It's not just that. It might be that for certain tests, we would specify minimum crew on board the airplane. If in spite of everything we can think of to reduce the risk, we still judge it to be high, then we take other steps to minimize the impact of the potential bad thing that could occur. Extend that to non-flight test scenario. Say you're legally current to fly weather instruments, but you're not very proficient, and you might just increase the minimums to which you file into. Same kind of idea.
And spinning it further back to general aviation pilots, those pilots are now seeing some serious avionics in aircraft as simple as sport planes. Part of your background, I understand, is with pilot-vehicle interface. How do you go about learning a new system aircraft or a new avionics system in an aircraft?
It's an important question. Some of the new gear that's available to the general aviation community is really tremendous and enhances safety. TCAS is a tremendous. Ground proximity warning systems are also very good. But some of the other things may be not so beneficial and can even be, I think, hazard-inducing.
Specifically what, and how do you mean?
Some of the displays are very compelling and can be distracting. And the worst thing that would be is not knowing the system very well. If you're in flight with that manual written in not very straightforward English about a very complex system that has a lot of capability, you can be distracted to the point that instead of enhancing safety, it might even detract from safety because of your distraction. You need to do a lot of pre-flight study. And many of the companies who develop these kind of systems also have software simulations. And those can be really, really good. Run on PCs and really make the system understandable and easy to use.
Overall, what's your impression of the integrated cockpits and multiple pixelated screens available in the new GA cockpit?
I have a personal gripe about some of them. And I think that some of those systems have excess ability, which maybe doesn't seem very straightforward on the surface. What I mean is that sometimes engineers and pilots both, but especially engineers, can enable a system that's capable to do a lot more things than the typical user uses. And you can lose perspective. If you're in the middle of a development program that goes on for a year or two of this hardware-software combination, you're very familiar with it, and the way it flows to the developer is very obvious. But then when you put all of the features in, the new guy who walks up to it might be a little difficult for him to find the things that are most important. So I would encourage, and I frequently do when I get involved with development programs, is for the developers of a system to back off a little bit and not put in every bell and whistle that could possibly be added. For example, how often do you need a button on your unit to go to the nearest airway intersection? It's really not a very useful feature. And if you have a lot of those useful features that are easier or able to be included, some companies will include them. And just because it doesn't cost any extra up front doesn't mean that it doesn't cost you when you try to find the stuff that you do need to find.
And it brings up an interesting point. I mean, the added complexity, and too often we can't fly as much as we'd like. Do you have any tips for someone trying to keep their head in the flying game when they can't actually go out and fly?
Yeah, and that's a situation we're confronted with here as well at times. And the answer, I think, is cockpit time. And chair flying, cockpit time and chair flying. Go out to the cockpit with a checklist and simulate all the normal and emergency procedures that you can. Find the switches, look at the displays, and just think through the flight and the scenarios. If necessary, you might hook up ground power. For some of the newer integrated displays, you can't do much power off. Hook up ground power and just go through. In addition, I like to do a little extra pre-flight planning when I haven't flown a plane for a while. Calculate your weight and balance, determine takeoff performance, et cetera, et cetera. I think basic flying skills are probably not the ones that need to be practiced as much by people in general, but it's those displays and emergency procedures and normal procedures and just going through the checklist is the most beneficial thing to me.
Well, Greg, we're very happy that we had time to sit down with Greg Lewis, Deputy Director of National Test Pilot School in Mojave. Greg, thank you so much for talking to our IFR magazine audience.
Well, thanks a lot for inviting me. I enjoyed it.
IFR's Glenn Pugh speaking with Greg Lewis, Deputy Director of the National Test Pilot School. You can check them out at www.ntps.edu. And you can learn more about IFR Magazine at our website, ifr-magazine.com. Thanks for listening.